Chapter 26. They came out of the darkness like muted demons, gliding across the water in silence. Black-clad men in black rubber boats dashing across a blackened sea. Tong Ju led the assault from the first boat, accompanied by five gritty-looking and heavily armed commandos, while Kim followed behind in a second boat with a similar contingent. Together, they raced towards the Sea Rover in rubber Zodiacs propelled by high-power electric motors, beefed-up versions of the trolling motors used by lake fishermen to cruise quietly. Only these boats were capable of running at 30 knots, emitting just a barely detectable hum. Running in the dead of night, the only audible evidence of their presence was the waves smacking against their semi-rigid hulls. On board the Sea Rover, the helmsman on watch glanced at a sweeping radar scope on the bridge, observing the large smudge of a ship off the starboard bow. The large cable ship that had stood a mile off the Sea Rover since they arrived on site was still sitting parked in the same position. He watched as a pair of faint white smudges appeared against the screen's green background periodically, positioned somewhere between the two ships. Too faint for a vessel this far from shore, he reckoned. More likely some cresting waves registering on the equipment. The two rubberized cresting waves throttled back as they approached within 100 meters of the Numa ship, creeping the remaining distance at a slow crawl. Tong Ju brought his boat alongside the starboard flank of the Sea Rover and waited momentarily while Kim's craft skirted around the ship's stern and eased up on the port side. In unseen unison, a pair of rubber-coated grappling hooks sailed up from the sea on either side of the ship, catching secure grips round the Sea Rover's lower deck railing. Narrow rope ladders trailing off the grappling hooks provided the means of entry. In orderly unison, the commandos quickly scrambled up the swaying lines. On the port deck, a sleepless marine biologist was taking in the night sky when he heard something strike the ship. A pronged hook materialized around the railing just a few feet away. Curious, he bent over the side to look down the trailing rope just as a black-capped head emerged from the other side. In mutual surprise, the two men banged heads together with a crack. The startled scientist fell back, groping for words to cry, but in an instant the commando was on deck, brandishing an assault rifle. The rifle stock caught the unfortunate biologist across the jawbone, and the man crumpled in an unconscious heap. The two commando teams assembled independently, then moved forward along the deck, intent on subduing the bridge and radio room first, before any calls for help could be sent. Silently creeping through the sleeping ship, their 2 a.m. raid found the vessel ghostly quiet. On the bridge, the Sea Rover's helmsman and second officer were sipping coffee while discussing college football. Without warning, Tong Ju and two of his men burst through the starboard wing door, aiming their weapons at the men's faces. "Down on the deck," Tong Ju yelled in clear English. The second officer quickly dropped to his knees, but the helmsman panicked. Dropping his coffee, he bolted for the port wing in a futile attempt at escape. Before Tong Ju or his men could cut the man down, one of Kim's commandos appeared in the doorway, striking the man in the chest with his assault rifle, then kicking him in the groin for good measure. The helmsman withered to the deck, groaning in agony. Scanning the bridge, Tong Ju saw that the adjacent communications bay was empty and nodded at one of the commandos to stand guard over the equipment. He then walked towards the door to the captain's cabin situated off the back of the bridge. With a silent nod, he ordered one of his men to charge in. Morgan was asleep in his bunk when the commando burst into his cabin, flicked on the light, and leveled his AK-74 assault rifle at the captain's head. The salty captain awoke immediately and sprang out of bed clad in t-shirt and boxers, bullying towards the man with the gun. "What's this all about?" he barked, storming his way towards the bridge. The startled commando hesitated in the doorway as the burly captain bore towards him. With a nearly invisible flick of his arm, Morgan knocked the muzzle of the firearm away from his chest and towards the ceiling, then with his free right hand, shoved the commando out the door with the strength of a barreling freight train. The shocked commando went sprawling across the bridge, falling on his backside and sliding with a thud into the forward bulkhead. The commando was still sliding across the deck when Tongju leveled his Glock 22 semi-automatic pistol and fired a single shot at Morgan. The 40-caliber slug ripped into and through Morgan's left thigh, throwing a spray of blood onto the wall behind him. Morgan cursed as he grabbed his leg before crumpling to the deck. "This is a United States government vessel," he hissed defiantly. "It is my ship now," Tongju replied coolly. "And any more insolence from you, Captain, and I shall place the next bullet into your skull." To emphasize his words, he stepped forward and flung his right leg towards the kneeling captain, the heel of his black boot striking Morgan high on the cheekbone and sending him sprawling flat to the deck. The proud captain slowly gathered himself back to his knees and stared quietly at his captor, eyes burning with hatred. Unable to warn his fellow shipmates, Morgan could only watch helplessly as the small team of intruders took over his ship. Little resistance was met elsewhere on the vessel as the commandos rounded up the sleeping crew at gunpoint. Only in the engine room did a brawny machinist's mate surprise one of the commandos, crushing a pipe wrench through his skull. The machinist was quickly subdued by gunshots from another assailant, but the wounds would not prove lethal. Sporadic gunfire began to resonate throughout the ship as the commando teams worked through the Sea Rover. In less than 20 minutes, the assault team had achieved their objective and taken control of the 350-foot research vessel. Tim Ryan and Mike Farley were in the undersea operations control room, monitoring the current dive of the Starfish, when a pair of commandos burst in on them. Ryan could only mutter a "what the hell?" over the underwater communication system before he was yanked away from the control station at gunpoint with Farley in tow. Like sheep led to the slaughterhouse, the shipboard crew was herded in groups of three and four to the rear deck of the Sea Rover. Astern of the moon pool was a recessed cargo hold where the submersible and other equipment was stored when not in use. Under Kim's direction, the hold's heavy steel hatch cover was winched off with one of the Sea Rover's cranes. The frightened captives were then forced down a steel ladder into the dark, cavernous bay. Tongju approached Kim on the rear deck with a bound and limping Morgan in tow, another commando prodding the captain forward with the barrel of his assault rifle. "Report," Tongju asked bluntly. "All objectives achieved," Kim reported proudly. "One casualty in the engine room, Takong, but all ship's compartments are now secure. We've transferred all the captives to the stern hold. Jin Chul reports that 8 units of ordnance have been located intact in the ship's auxiliary laboratory," he added, nodding towards a wiry commando standing next to a prefabricated structure across the deck. "The submersible is currently deployed in recovery of additional ordnance." "Very well," Tongju replied with a rare smile that revealed a set of heavily yellowed teeth. "Contact the Baekje. Tell her to tie up alongside and prepare for transfer of the ordnance." "You won't get far," Morgan growled, spitting out a mouthful of blood as he spoke. "But, Captain," Tongju replied with an evil smirk, "we already have." 1,000 feet beneath the Sea Rover, Summer was carefully placing the 10th aerial bomb into the makeshift holding tray alongside the 9th canister she had plucked from the bottom just moments before. She again secured both bombs with the mechanical arms, then turned to Dirk when she was finished. 10 down, 2 to go. "You may take us home now, Jeeves." "Yes, m'lady," he replied in a Cockney accent. Then he actuated the submersible's thrusters and backed out of the tight confines of the hangar. As they cleared the deck of the I-411, Summer radioed up to the Sea Rover's control room. "Sea Rover, this is Starfish. Have secured the next batch and are preparing to ascend with the goods. Over." The call was returned with silence. She tried calling several more times as they started their ascent, but again received no response from the surface. "Ryan must be asleep at the wheel," Dirk said. "Can't blame him," Summer replied while suppressing a yawn. "It is 2:30 in the morning." "I just hope the guy on the crane is awake," he smirked. As they neared the surface, they spotted the familiar glow of the moon pool lights and maneuvered the Starfish into the center of the ring, where they bobbed gently to the surface. Dirk and Summer paid scant attention to the shadowy figures on the deck as the clank of the main hoist was dropped and attached to the submersible, and they began to power down its electronic equipment. It was only when they were jerked roughly out of the water and swung wildly to the stern deck, nearly colliding with a port bulkhead, did they realize something was amiss. "Who the hell's working the crane?" Summer cursed as they were set down harshly on the deck. "Don't they know we've got two bombs aboard?" "It sure ain't the welcome wagon," Dirk said dryly as he stared out of the bubble window. Directly in front of them, an Asian man in a black paramilitary outfit stood holding an automatic pistol to the stomach of Captain Morgan. Dirk looked beyond the man's long Fu Manchu mustache and crooked yellow teeth splayed in an evil grin and focused on the eyes. They were cold, black eyes that portrayed a menacing air of utter indifference. They were, Dirk knew, the eyes of an experienced killer. Summer gasped at the sight of Morgan. A makeshift bandage was wrapped about his left thigh, but failed to cover the rivulets of dried blood that were splattered down his leg. His cheekbone was bruised and swollen to the size of a grapefruit, and his eye had already begun to blacken. More dried blood ran from his mouth and onto his shirt. Yet the crusty captain stood unflinching, his lack of fear so prominent that Summer failed to notice he was still wearing a pair of boxer shorts. A pair of commandos suddenly jumped in front of the starfish's acrylic bubble, waving their AK-74s about wildly in a show for Dirk and Summer to exit the submersible. The gun muzzles were quickly poked in their faces as they climbed out of the submersible and were marched over to Morgan and Tongju. "Mr. Pitt," Tongju said in a low voice, "good of you to join us." "I don't believe I've had the pleasure of your acquaintance," Dirk replied sarcastically. "A humble servant of the Japanese Red Army, whose name is unimportant," Tongju replied with feigned graciousness, bowing his head slightly. "I didn't realize there were still any of you fruitcakes left outside of jail." Tongju just held his grin, not moving a facial muscle. "You and your sister have 15 minutes to replenish the submersible's batteries and prepare to retrieve the final two ordnance," he said calmly. "They're both damaged and in pieces," Dirk lied, his mind racing to compute a plan of action. Tongju calmly raised the Glock pistol aimed at Morgan's side and held the muzzle to the captain's right temple. "You have 14 minutes, at which time I shall kill your captain. Then I will kill your sister. And then I will kill you," he said coldly, his lips parting in a self-satisfying grin. Dirk could feel the blood racing through his veins as he glared at the madman in anger. Then the delicate touch of Summer's hand on his shoulder dispelled any thoughts of rash action. "Come on, Dirk. We haven't much time," she said, guiding him to a wheeled cart that had been rolled out with replacement batteries for the submersible. Morgan looked at Dirk and nodded in concurrence. Fighting the feeling of total helplessness, he reluctantly began transferring the batteries to the starfish, all the while keeping one eye glued to the commando leader. As they prepped the submersible for a last dive, the final remnants of the ship's crew were marched by and forced into the rear hold at gunpoint. Summer grimly noted the frightened look on two lab analysts as they were prodded roughly down the hatchway. Working quickly, Dirk and Summer replaced the submersible's power supply in just over 12 minutes. There would be no time for the standard post-operation and pre-dive system checks normally performed before the submersible was returned to the water. They would have to hope the starfish was operational for one more dive. Tongju walked over in a measured clip and glared up at the two Americans, who both towered over him. "You will promptly retrieve the remaining ordnance and return to the vessel without any nonsense. You have 90 minutes to complete your dive successfully, or there will be severe consequences." "If I were you, I think I'd be worrying about the consequences from our military forces for pirating a government ship," Summer spat angrily. "There will be no consequences," Tongju replied, smiling thinly, "for a ship that no longer exists." Before Summer could respond, Tongju spun on his heels and walked away, replaced by two commandos who stepped forward with their assault rifles drawn and aimed. "Come on, sister," Dirk muttered. "There's no use arguing with a psychopath." Dirk and Summer threaded themselves back into the starfish, then were roughly jostled into the air by the crane operator. As they were prepared to be let go, Dirk watched through the acrylic bubble as Morgan was roughly manhandled to the stern hold and forcefully pitched down into the container. A commando on a stern deck crane hoisted up the massive steel hatch and positioned it over the rear hold before lowering it in place. Secured over the hold, the hatch imprisoned the entire ship's crew in darkness below. With a violent splash, the starfish was crudely dropped into the moon pool a second later and released from the ship's cable. "He means to sink the Sea Rover," Dirk said to Summer as they began their slow descent to the bottom. "With the entire crew locked in the hold?" she asked, shaking her head in disbelief. "I think so," he said somberly. "Unfortunately, there's not much we can do in the way of calling for help. Our underwater communication system won't do any good, and any surface calls we might try wouldn't have the range to reach anybody in this region except a few Chinese fishermen." "Or the cable ship that is evidently supporting these characters," he added, shaking his head. "Our intelligence heads apparently underestimated this Japanese Red Army," Summer said. "Those guys didn't look like a rogue band of ideological extremists with dynamite strapped to their backs. No, it's apparent they are well-trained military professionals. Whoever's running their operation is obviously skilled and well-funded. I wonder what they intend to do with the bombs. An attack in Japan would figure. But there's obviously more to this Japanese Red Army than meets the eye, so I wouldn't want to wager on what their intent is." "I guess we can't worry about that for now. We've got to figure out a way to save the crew." "I counted 8 commandos, and there was no doubt a few more on the bridge and elsewhere on the ship. Too many to overpower with a couple of screwdrivers," Dirk said, examining the contents of a small toolbox mounted behind his seat. "We'll need to quietly get some of the crewmen out of the hold to help us. If we had enough people, maybe we could overpower them." "I don't relish the thought of going unarmed against an AK-74, but there might be a chance in numbers. Getting the lid off that storage hold is the problem. I'd need a couple of uninterrupted minutes on the stern crane, but I don't think our friends in black would be too obliging." "There must be another way out of that hold," Summer wondered. "No, unfortunately there isn't. I'm sure it matches the Deep Endeavor, where it was designed strictly as a storage hold and is blocked off from any entry amidships by the moon pool. I thought Ryan had run a power cable down there once from someplace other than the open hatch cover." Dirk thought hard for a moment, trying to jog his memory. After a long minute, a light finally clicked on. "You're right. There's a small venting hatch that opens on the bulkhead just aft of the moon pool. It's really more of an air vent, designed to release the buildup of noxious gases if chemicals are stored in the hold. I'm pretty sure a man could squeeze through it. The problem for Morgan and the crew is that it's sealed and locked from the outside. We've got to figure out a way to unlock it," Summer willed. Together, they worked through several contingency plans, finally settling on an order of attack based on their opportunities once aboard the Sea Rover. It would take timing, skill, and a dose of daring to pull off. But mostly, it would take luck.